Perhaps the most interesting natural limit, however, is what might be called our social channel capacity. The case for a social capacity has been made most persuasively by the British anthropologist Robin Dunbar. Dunbar begins with a simple observation. Primates have the biggest brains of all mammals. More importantly, a specific part of the brains of humans and other primates, the region known as the neocortex that deals with complex thought and reasoning, is huge by mammal standards. For years, scientists have argued back and forth about why this is the case. The answer, Dunbar says, is group size. If you look at any species of primate, at every variety of monkey and ape, the larger their cortex is, the larger the average size of the groups they live with. Dunbar's argument is that brains evolve, they get bigger, in order to handle the complexities of larger social groups. If you belong to a group of 5 people, he points out, you have to keep track of 10 separate relationships. Your relationships with the 4 others in your circle, and the 6 other two-way relationships between the others. That's what it means to know everyone in the circle. You have to understand the personal dynamic between each person, juggle different personalities, keep people happy, manage the demands on your own time and attention, and so forth. If you belong to a group of 20 people, however, there are now 190 two-way relationships to keep track of, 19 involving yourself and 171 involving the rest of the group. That's a 5-fold increase in the size of the group, but a 20-fold increase in the amount of information processing needed to know the other members of the group. Even a relatively small increase in the size of a group, in other words, creates a huge additional social and intellectual burden. Humans socialize in the largest groups of all primates because we are the only animals with brains large enough to handle the complexities of that social arrangement. Dunbar has actually developed an equation, which works for most primates, in which he plugs in what he calls the neocortex ratio for particular species, the size of the neocortex relative to the size of the brain, and the equation spits out the expected maximum group size of the animal. If you plug in the neocortex ratio for Homo sapiens, you get a group estimate of 147.8, or roughly 150. Dunbar writes, "The figure of 150 seems to represent the maximum number of individuals with whom we can have a genuinely social relationship, the kind of relationship that goes with knowing who they are and how they relate to us. Putting it another way, it's a number of people you would not feel embarrassed about joining uninvited for a drink if you happen to bump into them in a bar." Dunbar has combed through the anthropological literature and found that the number 150 pops up again and again. For example, he looks at 21 different hunter-gatherer societies from which we have solid historical evidence, from the Walbiri of Australia to the Tuareg of New Guinea, and found that the average size of their villages was 148.4. We have seen in this program how a number of relatively minor changes in our external environment can have a dramatic effect on how we behave and who we are. Clean up graffiti, and all of a sudden people who would otherwise commit crimes suddenly don't. The rule of 150 suggests that the size of a group is another one of those subtle contextual factors that can make a big difference. If we want groups to serve as incubators for contagious messages, as they did in the case of Divine Secrets of the Yaya Sisterhood, we have to keep them below the 150 tipping point. Above that point, there starts to be structural impediments for the ability of the group to agree and act with one voice. Crossing the 150 line is a small change that can make a huge difference. Perhaps the best example of an organization that has successfully navigated this problem is Gore Associates, a privately held, multi-billion-dollar high-tech firm based in Newark, Delaware. At Gore, there are no titles. If you ask someone who works there for their card, it will just say their name and underneath it the word associate, regardless of how much money they make, or how much responsibility they have, or how long they've been at the company. People don't have bosses, they have sponsors, mentors, who watch out for their interests. There are no organization charts, no budgets, no elaborate strategic plans. Salaries are determined collectively. Headquarters for the company is a low-slung, unpretentious red brick building. The executive offices are small, plainly furnished rooms along a narrow corridor. The corners of Gore buildings tend to be conference rooms or free space, so no one can be said to have a more prestigious office than someone else. When I visited a Gore associate named Bob Henn at one of the company's plants in Delaware, I tried unsuccessfully to get him to tell me what his position was. I suspected, from the fact that he had been recommended to me, that he was one of the top executives. But his office wasn't any bigger than anyone else's. His card just called him an associate. He didn't seem to have a secretary that I could see anyway. He wasn't dressed any differently from anyone else.